Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, reporting on a variety of venues as well as my own website, healthjournalist.com. I've also been an author and co-author of books, as a collaborator, as a writer, and as an author. Out there in the social media world, you can find me on my website as well as on my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health. Every week on this show, Connecting the Dots, we connect the dots between the things that affect our well-being and personal health that come to us from that are not biochemically within our body and our immediate control, but that come to us from the larger context, the environment in which we live. This includes our family environment, our neighborhood, our community, our city, state, region, country, and the world. A lot of the decisions that we make on all those different levels affect our well-being and the well-being of our families, the earth, and future generations. So every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between different facets of that by talking to authors, experts, advocates, thought leaders, doctors, and many organizers, and many, many more. And thus, we report here on the show on a wide range of different issues. Thank you. I'm thankful in this Thanksgiving and holiday season for you listeners, and for all the wonderful guests that we've had on over the 4 years that we've had this program. And also urge you to check out our archives. We've really had just one exceptional and terrific thought leader after another on this program, and it's been my honor to bring them to you and to engage with them in conversation about these important, critical issues and our need to get engaged and involved. Today's guest is Robert Goff, and we're going to be talking about the indigenous perspectives on the environment and climate change. He is an attorney with graduate degrees in sociology and cultural anthropology, specializing in cultural ecology. He has worked with Indian tribes on cultural and national resource issues for over 30 years. In 1994, he served as the first director of the Rosebud Sioux Tribal Utility Commission, overseeing the initiation of the tribe's wind turbine project, and he's been a consulting attorney, the member of various boards. He's been a research fellow at various distinguished academic organizations, and he's also served as the founding secretary of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, an organization created to provide information on rights and resources for utility services on tribal lands. Back when he got involved as the founding secretary of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, which I think we're going to be calling COUP in terms of its nickname, C-O-U-P, the letters that stand in its name, that seemed pretty prescient. And now, of course, the indigenous leadership, resistance, and activism is visible on many fronts, both in the U.S. and internationally in Canada, to protect lands from exploitation by corporate energy companies. So we've got a very rich topic, which is both the affronts to environmental values and the indigenous view and activism in protecting the earth. So it's my delight to welcome to Connect the Dots, Bob Goff. Welcome, Bob.
Good morning. Good morning. Delighted to be here and a part of this illustrious line of folks who've been very influential in much of the work that we've been doing through. And it's pronounced Intertribal Coup, C-O-U, as the French would pronounce it. As in
oh, I see.
Coup,
mm-hmm.
As well.
Coup. Very good. Oh, I like that very much, of course.
It's even better. That's right.
Yes. Do you want to define the French meaning of coup for
people
who may not be acquainted with it?
It's understood as a coup d'etat. It means the head, but it means touching the head. A coup d'etat means you've touched the head of government and changed it in some form. But on the Great Plains, the honorable way of doing battle was counting coup. You didn't kill your opponent. You merely demonstrated that you had the opportunity to do that. You would touch them with a stick and show that you could have killed them. You get to ride off and sing a victory song. They are shamed out, but the next day the two of you can meet again in battle. Very different from warfare conducted with rifles at football length distance, and a much more honorable way of encounter that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years on the Great Plains.
You know, that brings back a question for me, given that in addition to your outstanding leadership with your legal skills, insights, connections, knowledge of environmental and energy policy and all, you know, in addition, there is, you know, you studied, before you even got your law degree, you studied cultural anthropology and ecology. And so the question that comes up for me upon hearing this wonderful story is, you know, one of the things I think that many people see and kind of are nonplussed or sort of frozen by and puzzled by or outraged by is the shamelessness and the lack of a sense of honor in the way many companies lack care for the lands, plant life, species, humans affected by our you know, activities and impacting the environment. There seems like the presence of the sense of honor, the lack of the lack of shame. You know, there's right away in defining that territory, you're bringing in something very fundamental about how to reframe and heal the values that we hold and allow and act on as a society. Could you share a little bit more about, the notions, the understandings about, honor, shame, the honorable ways of interacting in situations where different sides have different perspectives, that you hold and that the indigenous peoples, and you were part of that lineage yourself, hold?
Sure. I think you've put your finger on something very essential, actually, to the whole understanding of an indigenous perspective, and that is that it comes from respect, and the honor or the dishonor that's done often to the environment, the lack of respect shown to it, it's because of how it is, in some senses, how it is framed in our minds. If it's merely an objective world that's nothing but inanimate objects and resources to be utilized carefree, that's one attitude, one perspective one could have. People like Orrin Lyons and Dan Wildcat and others who've been engaged in these conversations for 20 and moving on to 30 years or longer with regard to native environmental perspectives and the like, often speak that about the concept of a difference between the West and indigenous mindsets is what one calls resources, the other calls relatives. And if the earth is your mother, a relative, if the trees, if the plants, if the biology of where you live, of your environment, are all relatives, and you have to live in a respectful relationship with them, then you treat them very differently than you do if they're just a commoditized piece of property to be grabbed, used, and tossed away, and then move on to the next piece of unused property. So what you've started with here goes to the heart of that indigenous perspective, I think, that is held worldwide by people and it has been held by Europeans for many years in their tribal context, and kind of has gone away with modernization and the industrial world worldview taking hold.
Mm-hmm. In effect, what you're you know, I think that the American view, you know, the view of many Americans is, you know, does contain loyalty, you know, to the group they come from, their immediate family, people of a similar background, you know, or, you know, themselves as individuals and those in their circle, you know, so there is loyalty, but it's not as anywhere near as broad and encompassing, you know, as the kind of respect and loyalty to larger connection that that you're describing, which sounds so rich compared with this kind of shrunken, narrower sense of, you know, to whom am I loyal? Who is my relative? Who is my group? You know, we don't see ourselves. I mean, we first met, I believe, on Facebook through a group that's, you know, kind of calling itself a tribe. This is the sense that there are larger tribes beyond, you know, one's immediate relationships, even extending to many other people that we may not, you know, encounter personally very often. I mean, that's been one of the that was one of the hopes of social media, through which we met. But I don't know if it always delivers it in the living way that you're describing, or you know, if it also even a tool that has that potential, if the values aren't held, it can also be used in an extremely instrumental fashion as well, and exclude that sense. You know, how, as someone from a Native background, and I know that people, you know, from Native backgrounds grow up in many different ways, some at a distance, you know, from their tribes, their native regions and all of that. So I don't want to make any assumptions there. But, you know, based upon your background and upbringing and those of the people that you speak of and know, you know, it seems like it must be a very different experience to be raised in an atmosphere from earliest years where there is that understanding versus to be raised where there's a very different understanding, you know, and try to acquire it later in life.
It is possible to do so. Mm-hmm. In my own experience, and I guess I would expand something you just said first, and it doesn't apply just to people. It applies to place. And one can have loyalty to place that goes beyond ownership of real estate, and it's far greater and deeper in the sense of understanding how a place, an environment, an ecology operates and has operated for millennia before you have ever arrived, and will continue to operate long after each one of us individuals are gone. There's a sense that I got when I worked up at Mole Lake, which was a little community in northern Wisconsin, being faced by, threatened actually by large-scale mineral development by Exxon, looking to develop the largest zinc-copper deposit in North America, that threatened their little wild rice lake a mile and a half or so downstream from where the deposit was located. And that was nestled in the headwaters of the Wolf River, a wild and scenic river in Wisconsin. I did my field work for my dissertation in anthropology out of Wisconsin up there. And while living with the community there, there were a number of occasions where I would participate as a friend or observer, if you will, but a participant in the community in a funeral. And no matter what religion the person followed, and there were several religions active on the reservation, most of the services were held at a little community church building, non-denominational, and then the casket would be put into a wagon or a bed of some sort, truck or bed, and brought about a quarter mile to the cemetery. and the entire community would walk behind that casket. Mm-hmm. And I remember the moment I had the realization that everyone in that line knew that someday they'd be in the front of that line.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, you realize a community's tie to a sense of place, a tie to a particular piece of geography that they and all of their ancestors have known, and that they will be, put back into or interred back there. And I remember that being a very deep touching of what it means to be a community in a particular place. I was brought up, born in Newark, actually, not too far from where you're broadcasting from, I guess.
That's
and
right.
Was raised down in Port Monmouth, at the bottom of the Raritan Bay, known as New York Harbor for a lot of other folks. But it was the Bay of the Raritan River, and that is in the traditional homeland of the Lenape people. Although my people were moved out of there in the 1800s, 1700s, after the French and Indian War, and many families moved west and south and ended up with the Cherokee in Oklahoma, my family ended up in Montreal, near Montreal in Canada. And then individuals came back to the homeland. And we continued a lot of the same practices in terms of hunting and fishing and relying on the marine animals until, actually in my case, when I was 15, 16 years old, Exxon, which was then Standard Oil of New Jersey, brought in so much oil, crude oil from cheap oil from the Middle East, and they were dumping and cleaning their tankers right there in the bay with the waters there. And soon enough, we could no longer eat the clams or the crabs or the fish from the bay because of the pollutants that came from that industrial practice of tankers coming to the refineries. So it's a very personal note that when I found them, Exxon, up in the north woods of Wisconsin, I knew that my alliance and my allegiance would be to the local people who were trying to maintain and keep a way of life and a culture alive based on the resources and the relatives that had wild rice in this case. So it's a very personal coming together of values and experience for me to be doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. I believe, you know, I was thinking about this and I was realizing, you know, that in my sharing of information and everything on Facebook, I probably share things that you post more than any other individual. I mean, very likely that's the case. I think it's not always true, but I think it's pretty true. And I think you may have posted about this, where a company that was coming up into, and I apologize for not remembering the precise details, but a large corporation that was coming up into a region and wanting yet again to, I believe it was in Canada, drill through lands, and in this case they were also lands where wild rice is cultivated. They were counter-arguing in a court conflict that was held, saying, well, you don't really eat this rice, do you? Prove that you eat the rice.
Mm-hmm.
To the native tribe that was in opposition, and, you know, in trying to protect their rice cultivation lands and everything.
Right.
And I don't know if you know the specific instance that I'm referring to, but I was so struck by the attempt to quantify. You know, because at the end of the day, what are they going to say? Oh, well, it's only, you know, so-and-so many gallons or bags of rice compared with, you know, yada-yada. I mean, how do you, you know, when you get it down to a number, it's kind of meaningless. When you're talking about traditional foods, local subsistence, following the pathway and the history and way of life of your ancestors, you know, keeping ecologically viable the region either where you live and or where your ancestors reside. All of that, you know, those different kinds of things are in the balance.
Priceless. Mm-hmm. I think that credit card commercial tallies up things, but it, the bottom line is priceless.
Right. Right.
That's the addition that needs to be done. That's the metric that needs to be considered. And in my work at Northern Wisconsin, I was standing by the side of the tribal council and representatives from Exxon when one of their officers said to one of their consultants, "I just don't understand why these Indians are so concerned about these lake weeds." And we said, "Yes, that's evident. You don't understand that." So part of the work we engaged in was explicating the importance of that crop historically, and that particular lake bed historically to the community, going back, oh gosh, almost 250 years. So, which is a long period of time for history in northern Wisconsin, less so in, you know, New York and the East Coast, but there's documentary proof of that community relying on that resource. So I very much agree with you and appreciate the fact that was one of the posts that you carried on and reposted. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because it's a very big educational process. For
right.
those who don't intrinsically, you know, hold these values to consider, you know, when you mention where you originally grew up and in the lower New Jersey part of the larger New York Harbor area, and you know what happened when Exxon came in and polluted those waterways and all of that, and I, being from that region and that place, you know, in the United States, being from New York City and Martha's Vineyard. You know, I recall we'd be driving past those refinery areas, and as a child, you know, and it's true to this day, actually, but, you know, and there was always this horrible stench. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's the smell of the pollution and all of the stuff that's released. It was probably, I mean, very likely it's my first and most routine exposure to, something, you know, an industrial activity is going on, something smells bad here, you know. And then, of course, being working in the health field, the whole impact of toxicity on the biology of living creatures, including ourselves and all of that, you know, became much later. But that was probably my first exposure. And I remember thinking at the time, like holding my nose when we went past that particular place in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And sort of saying, ooh, New Jersey is a place that smells, you know, and it kind of formed this mental impression.
Mm-hmm.
New Jersey smells. And, of course, as an 8-year-old, you wouldn't be asking, you know, why, or saying, well, it's not just New Jersey, you know. But it
does give you a good basis upon which to imagine Mordor as one reads through storybooks and the like. Places like that you know otherwise are very unnatural in the natural world, very unusual in the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we're trying, you know, we're kind of thoughtlessly creating out of places that are in ecological integrity that kind of place, and then we're trying to, you know, I think we're trying to hold our nose, you know, mm-hmm. and sort of not smell it.
Right. And hold our breath. And then
right.
not drink the water, and then not eat the food.
Right.
Yeah, that's not a critical path to survival. I had a yoga teacher explain to me once that the basics are breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, and if you can't handle that, don't worry about enlightenment. You know, some basic things need to be tended to, and one of the basic things that the modern world, industrial world, doesn't get is that the economies are a subset of the ecologies. They are a small part of the overall environment. It's not a trade-off of one and the other. And they keep making that by raising, elevating economy to a much higher plane than environment. And it's just a misguided understanding. And from that misunderstanding, you can make a whole lot of mistakes. And getting us back on track, I think, to a more sensible and palatable world, we need to clear and reframe and re-understand, come to a better or a former re-understanding of how the world really is and how it really works. And this carries right into all the climate work that we've been involved with through Intertribal Coup and the tribes and indigenous peoples worldwide. It's saying that, you know, this planet, indigenous peoples are the first and worst hit with the dramatic changes coming about in our climate today. They're happening now. They were happening yesterday. They were happening the day before. They're not somewhere off in the modeled future of climate sciences. They are going on now. Mm-hmm. But affluent cultures and affluent societies tend to be buffered from the effects of that. I mean, we think climate change is getting on an airplane in New York and getting off in Miami. Okay, now you've changed climates, okay? And what's so bad about that? It's kind of nice. Well, in some ways, yes. But what's going on in terms of the actual changing of the planet's climates are that we are disrupting habitats that have been intact and nourishing and providing entire ecosystems a basis upon which to thrive. And we are pulling those threads out of that tapestry, one by one, one after another. And climate change does it in a very big way, in an unanticipated way. We had no idea that digging up carbon out of the earth that has been put there for at least 775 million years, probably closer to 200 million years for most of the anthracite, taking that sequestered carbon that was once in the atmosphere, a very deadly atmosphere in terms of our ability to adjust to it, but an atmosphere in which the plants grew for millions of years, taking that carbon out of the air, falling over, piling up, getting crushed, getting covered, and becoming coal beds or oil beds, and taking all of that out in the course of 50 years, 100 years, and combusting it, putting it back into the atmosphere at such a quick pace. We have physically changed the chemistry of the atmosphere of this planet. And we never intended to do that. We, in fact, a lot of people don't believe that humans have that ability to even affect the atmosphere of the planet. But we have. It's a human fingerprint, a dark, dirty carbon fingerprint on the firmament, on the sky above us. And that is now causing changes that are rippling through and pushing us past ecological thresholds all around the planet. And that's going on. It's been going on. And indigenous peoples who have depended upon intact habitats for subsistence culture have recognized that the seasons have been slipping. So when we did our first Native peoples, Native homelands, climate workshops, we didn't have to instruct people that climate change was happening. The rest of the workshops, 19 of them around the U.S., spent a lot of times with local communities explaining what climate change was and how it was happening. That wasn't necessary in Indian country with indigenous peoples in Alaska, Hawaii, Samoa, the Pacific Islands. These are folks who living closer to the environment, to the natural world in which they are taking their daily bread, if you will. They are noticing changes in the behavior of the plants and the animals due to these changes in the atmosphere. So it's a very different perspective. It's a very old, ancient perspective, but it's one that we have, you know, shaken loose from in modernity, and to our peril. and to the peril of the entire planet, because we're capable of taking everything with us at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So good morning. How are
good
you?
Good morning. Well, you know, it's interesting because I was just thinking, I remember sort of saying to somebody recently over the last month, where we have up until recently in the northeastern region, we've had unseasonably warm weather, during much of October and into November, quite warm. The 50s, the 60s, creeping up towards very warm weather. And so, of course, people are saying things like lovely day. And these are non-Indigenous regions, obviously, saying lovely day, And so somebody would say, oh, isn't it beautiful now? So unseasonably warm. And I said to somebody, we're enjoying it now, but, of course, we know that it's due to climate change. It was kind of like, I think the person was stunned at the reminder. It's like we're seeing the same thing, we're seeing an artifact in our area, but we don't know, how to kind of factor that in. That it's nice now, and it seems nice, but it's going to be, but it's part of a unfortunate unraveling trajectory, as eloquently articulate in everything. So there's a real kind of, so basically what you're describing is that the Indigenous peoples, because they live so close to the earth, are actually in place as, the Cassandra that really knows how to understand, notice, interpret the situation. So in fact, you were much earlier in being concerned about this problem overall. This is not like you just sprang up 2 years ago to become an environmentalist. You've been, for the very same reasons, you've been noticing this over much of time. So you're really kind of drafted. What do you see as your job, your duty to the environment, you and the peoples?
One of them is the title of your show, Connecting the Dots. Mm-hmm. And most people don't even have enough dots to connect. So there's an education piece there that's required. But and that's why, because of that lack of science education, and lack of ongoing intimate experience with the natural world, it's easy for the climate deniers to poison the well and to distract people and to throw out examples of, it's very cold, so how could it be global warming? Well, the fact that the cold from the Arctic has slipped down because the ice is gone from a lot of the Arctic Ocean, and the warmer water coming, as the waters do come from the equator, that warming has shifted the jet streams and has allowed the polar vortexes to drop down periodically in ways that we haven't experienced before. So just because you have ice doesn't mean it's not getting warmer out. We're getting ice on the roads in the Dakotas and on the power lines in the Dakotas more than we have in the past. In the past, it would be cold enough that precipitation would come down as snow, and that doesn't build up on the wires. Ice, it's warm enough to come down as rain and then freeze down here, right at the surface, and that ice does build up, and we find sometimes we lose, 20 miles of power lines to the ice, and we see ice storms happening of that sort. So these weather extremes that we are seeing can be cold or can be hot. We're not seeing 150 degree days on the Great Plains, 150 degrees, but we are seeing weeks where we may get 110, 115 for triple digits for 3 weeks in a row. And that is something we've never seen before, that kind of duration of heat. And that, too, taxes the infrastructure, the power lines short out, transformers short. Power is drawn because of people wanting to use air conditioners because of the heat and the like, and it just overloads the circuits that were infrastructure that was not designed for these conditions. And that's what we're seeing happening throughout the world, is the failure of infrastructure that has been designed for a norm that we are no longer confined to. We are experiencing weather extremes. And as I've ran into climate deniers in a lot of the work in the past, we don't necessarily have to talk about climate. We can talk about weather extremes, and now that does two things. Number one, there are no weather deniers. Nobody denies weather, so you get right past the climate argument of whether the climate change is real or not. Weather extremes are real, and that's what people experience, and everyone has experienced them. So everyone is an expert on their experience of a weather extreme. And you can engage in the conversation about how do we deal with these kinds of changes that are coming? How do we deal with those kinds of things? So that gets us into conversations about adaptation that make a whole lot more sense than arguing of whether or not it really is 395 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere or 400 parts per million, and what difference does that 5 parts make? And, you know, we don't need to be arguing in terms of the scientific, technological, and technical inputs. We can start addressing the questions of how do we deal with these things as human beings, as families, as communities, as governments, and the like. So it shifts the questions a bit, and I think in a more productive area.
How do we deal with them? How do we deal with them nationally and internationally? How do we deal with them regionally and in communities?
That's an interesting question, because the recent study released by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN in the 80s asked this distinguished body of worldwide scientists, climate modelers and the like, that had never been brought together on a single question. This is the largest single scientific inquiry ever conducted by the human species. And climate scientists from all over the world have been participating in this, and they were basically asked 4 questions. Is climate change real? And if so, are humans responsible for it? And are there things that we can change that humans are doing in terms of that responsibility? Can they be responsible enough to stop the things that are causing this change, to mitigate the causes of climate change? And then the fourth one is the things that we can't stop, the things that we've put into play already, the thresholds that have been, the tipping points that have been crossed. How do we live with that? How do we cope with that? How do we adapt to that? And this august body of climate, earth, and atmospheric scientists have said, question number one, is it real? Yes. Number two, human fingerprint on it? Yes. No question about it. 95% consensus. We buy fire insurance for your house on a much smaller, much larger level of uncertainty than the 5% in terms of climate science says. So anyone who denies climate science, you should just give up your fire insurance policies and all sorts of other things, because apply that same logic and you'll see where you'll get. The third question, mitigation, that requires pointing fingers at behavioral practices that we have been engaged in, and that is basically industrial society based on fossil fuel combustion, putting carbon, unearthing it, that it's been stored away forever, and putting it in the atmosphere in an instant in terms of geologic time. That requires pointing fingers at the coal industries, the oil and gas industries, the utilities, and a whole lot of other industries that have brought us the wonders of the modern world through this exporting of carbon into the atmosphere without any consideration to the impacts it's going to have, and it is having and has already had on the environment. So that's the tricky political part. How do you deal with those vested interests, the money that they're able to throw around in politics, all of that stuff? That third question is very difficult, and that's why so much money has been put into the from the Koch brothers and other fun kind of folks to dissemble the questions and really confuse the general public and allow them to continue doing what they're doing at high rates of profit by basically privatizing all of the profit and socializing all of the costs. That's the way that industry has worked now. The final question, the fourth question, how are we going to live? What are we going to do about the situation, given the changes that are already loaded in the pipeline and are already being realized around the planet? Mm-hmm. Sandy, sea level rise, storm surges and the like, that kind of thing. How are we going to learn to live with those? And these climate scientists come back to the UN and they said, you know, this is human behavior. That's not our role. That's not our realm. That's not our expertise. We got nothing for you on that score. But to tell you, governments of the world, go back and talk to your local people. Go back and talk to your indigenous peoples. Go back and talk to people who've lived through, without necessarily reliance on fossil fuels, who've lived through extreme weather events where you are, in the places you are in the past, because these folks may have some better idea than we do as to how to live and what to do about surviving and thriving in a world without necessarily combustion, all the fossil fuels we can get our hands on. So it's been an interesting convergence now of indigenous peoples and climate science worldviews. Both of whom are systems thinkers, ecologists, if you will, mm-hmm. and seeing the whole rather than just profiting on some stovepipe part of the processes that we've been involved with.
Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a so that's part of, no doubt, the actual initiatives that you're doing with the communities. Do you want to describe some of those for our listeners?
Sure. We're working with tribes, particularly in the Great Plains, but all over the country, actually, and indigenous peoples throughout the world. We've been limiting our work to those within the United States, broadly stated, and that includes Alaska Natives, Native Hawaiians, Samoans, Pacific Islanders, Caribbean Islanders. These are local peoples and indigenous peoples who see the value of renewable energy, of local distributed energy production and generation that can be produced right there at your doorstep, at your rooftop, and can power your economy, whatever that economy happens to be, agriculture, milling, or whatever it happens to be. Find ways of being able to energize your economy without reliance on fossil fuel. And this is not an easy task. I was down in Samoa, American Samoa, back in at the turn of the century, just before the war broke out in the Middle East, the most recent wars broke out in the Middle East, and the community, the government there, was very concerned because their entire island energy system, sanitation system, water system. All of these, this infrastructure depends upon several diesel gen sets that require diesel fuel, none of which is found or generated or produced on the island. They wait for the next tanker of oil, and they've been doing this since around World War II. The Navy has got them in the habit now of importing oil, importing energy, importing food, and they've become reliant on that system. And what has happened is, as they want to go to renewables, they found that the importation of diesel subsidizes the importation of food to their island. That if they gave up buying the diesel tanker wouldn't come and wouldn't happen to have foodstuffs on it, food supplies. So they'd have to order it and pay for the entire transportation of just the food. So what these indigenous communities are looking at now are basically relocalizing food production back on these islands in ways that they've not done since prior to World War II and in the presence of the Navy in the Pacific. So it's been very interesting to see. Right now, Hawaii, for example, imports most of the food that it consumes. 150 years ago, Hawaii was the prime producer of food for California. They produced most of the food consumed in California by the miners and the folks who came out there for the gold rush, because there wasn't the big farm systems. It was a lot of desert, and we did not have desert agriculture in the Euro-American mindset that was required at the time. We have since just not done desert agriculture in California, but we've transformed the deserts with irrigation from the Colorado and other rivers, and now we produce most of the nation's food, a good deal of it, in California. And they've been suffering for drought, and now with fires, and now with flooding from the storms coming in, we keep seeing increases in our food costs going up. But it's interesting to watch that whole process. It's transformed the Pacific, and it is. We are now looking for the next step in a transformation to get us back to more locally produced foodstuffs, more locally produced energy. Tribes in the Great Plains are looking at housing made of straw bale that is a local material from wheat or barley or oats or even rice. You can make that from the stalks. It's a waste product, but that can give you an R40 insulation value that when it gets down to 30 below or 50 below with wind chill from the polar vortex, you can still maintain a 60, 70 degree temperature indoors at pennies for energy production. Because of the great insulation capacity. And we found out, we weren't looking for it. In the summertime, all that insulation keeps the house cooler than normal. It can keep it at room temperature. It operates the same way that a thermos operates, that you don't know the inside temperature because of the insulation value of the thermos bottle. You can't tell it from touching the outside. The outside environment doesn't affect the inside environment. We now do that with very little insulation and lots of energy inputs. So we've got to find more ways to do it without energy inputs, but do it in a way that conserves energy, reduces carbon, and provides a very comfortable place to live, and do it in an affordable price. Insulation, once you've put it in, that one-time cost serves you the life of the building rather than monthly energy inputs. So indigenous peoples are looking at the best we have, at the simplest technologies, the most appropriate technologies for the job at hand, and not necessarily go for big central system energy production or cheap, affordable housing only because it's an upfront cheap cost and you pay in the operation. Instead, you should put a few more dollars in upfront, and then the operating costs are reduced significantly, 60-70%.
Wow. That's really, I mean, that's really impressive. And an R40 is really incredible, actually.
Most of the insulation that goes in this country is like R19. And,
right.
And that's while it's packaged in the plastic bag. Once you open it, it starts going down. Because the way you install it, the holes you cut into it, everything else, the R value drops significantly.
It's probably a fine point for the radio program, but I happen to be curious about this. Is this something where you have to build the house from scratch using straw bale, or can it actually be used to insulate an existing house that's not built for that purpose?
Existing buildings, concrete, cement block buildings, have been retrofitted. We are looking at the opportunity of actually wrapping trailers. And rather than wrapping all four sides of trailers, since a lot of people own trailers because of land tenure issues, you can get a loan for a trailer even if you don't own the land it sits on, because reservation land is held in trust. Individuals don't own the land, can't alienate it, can't sell it. But rather than just wrapping all four sides, you can orient it towards the sun, the trailer, set the trailer up so the long width is east and west, and you've got a north-south facing areas, and you wrap the west, north, and east sides of the trailer, and then instead of just wrapping the front towards the south, you bring it out and extend it and double the space, make another big front room inside, you know, inside of the straw, and thereby you've doubled the living space and have significantly cut the energy usage and overall cost of it, and you've utilized the existing utility core of the trailer. So there are ways of adapting that we're going to have to get sharper on. And retrofitting.
And,
right.
Yeah. And you're actually, you know, I mean, I think this is applicable to a lot of regions and a lot of situations. And so this is stuff that also you're kind of developing and looking at and figuring out the adaptation for your situation, you know, in terms of the landing permits and the kinds of structures and all the rest of it. That's really fascinating. Could you speak also a little bit about the places where there are, you know, open face downs and attempts to you know, build energy infrastructures in a way that is to the detriment of existing lands and regions and species and rivers and all the rest of it? You know, take your pick, which would be one you'd want to share with our listeners.
I'm not sure I understand the question completely.
Well, for example, we originally had a conversation because I had seen a short film that Winona LaDuke had presented at a conference. Yeah, that would be an example of that.
Okay.
Well,
that's the film was about their riding the path of a pipeline to carry oil or tar sand sludge across through the U.S. Whether it's Enbridge coming down into Minnesota, or what we're dealing with, which is the Keystone Pipeline, really is the line in the sand. It's a large pipeline that literally will divide the United States from Montana to Texas, from the Canadian border to the Gulf of Mexico. It will divide the United States into an east-west country, and it'll cross the Oglala Aquifer in the Dakotas and in Nebraska and down into Kansas before it gets to Texas. And tribal peoples in Canada, First Nations, and in the U.S., have signed on to the Mother Earth Accord, which can be Googled and you can read it, folks can read it. But that accord basically spells out indigenous understanding of the environment and the opposition, where the opposition comes to the Keystone Pipeline. And as the president of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe said when the House voted to approve the Keystone Pipeline, that basically they've just, the House of Representatives has declared war on the Lakota people, because these are folks who plan to depend on the Oglala Aquifer for water for eternity, forever. That's water that has been there. That's water that now doesn't, that fails to recharge effectively because of how much we're pumping out of it for irrigation. But to pollute it on top of that is a major insult to the people and to the environment. Excuse me.
Yeah, no, that's really sad. I mean, that's tragic, actually. And, you know, asking listeners to, you know, support this. How can support, you know, the Lakota people in resisting this? What's the best way for people to do that, to support that very important standing ground on that?
Well, it's going to come back to Congress when they reopen for business after the new year with the newly elected Congress. They're going to take that item up. Republicans have promised to do that. I think if enough people can show their support for stopping it and letting their Congress people know that in no uncertain terms, that's not what they were elected to be doing, and that the bulk of the American people support what's been called actually the Cowboy and Indian Alliance, the CIA of the Great Plains. When the membership of two very different cultures, the cowboy rancher and the Indian on the Great Plains, although many of them are cowboys and ranchers themselves, but when those two historically different cultures combine together to stand up for the rights of all of the people along those that pipeline route to have a future of clean water to rely upon, and to make sure that a foreign company, TransCanada, is not given the sovereign governmental rights of power of eminent domain to condemn the property of both indigenous peoples and cowboys and ranchers and the America's heartland, to convert that land as a conduit for the worst of the oil resources that have been found on the planet.
I hear our closing music coming up here, but I want to thank you, and I want to urge listeners to stay on top of this issue. We'll continue to cover it on this program and take a stand with the cowboys and the ranchers and the Indians and all the peoples fighting to preserve, you know, the water and the country and this earth. And I want to thank you so much, Bob. This has been terrific hearing your wisdom and perspective. And thank you for being here with us on Connect the Dots today.
My pleasure. Thank you for getting my blood boiling on a cold day.
And I hope your flu is leaves your body based on that. I know you've been kind of fighting that one off.
You've raised the temperature. You bet. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, listeners. And please come back next week for another edition of Connect the Dots at 10 a.m. Wednesday Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.